breathe, it's in you. You don't die, you just get recycled. And of course, from that follows the third lie. You can be like God. Reincarnation. We are evolving. Evolution is not a, in this particular book, and I don't have any copies here to sell you, I don't believe. One of my chapter titles is From Slime to Divine. Because evolution is not a modern scientific theory. You can trace it back hundreds of years B.C. It has been part of the occult of Eastern mysticism for thousands of years. What's the point? It's how reincarnation works. What's the point of being reincarnated back here again and again unless you are progressing? You're evolving higher. And ultimately the goal is Godhood, deity, deity yoga, the Dalai Lama calls it. You don't have to wait around for reincarnation. You can get it through this altered state. You can achieve it. Now, let me give you one example from the world of the cults. Scientology. Scientology is growing today, believe it or not, even after the death of L. Ron Hubbard. And they're finding a lot of credibility in, you know, among intelligent people. Here's what Scientology says. I'll just give you, I mean, there's so many we could talk about, but let me give it to you in a nutshell. Scientology says that we are all uncreated, omnipotent, omniscient beings called Thetans, T-H-E-T-A-N-S. Somebody says that's Satan with a lisp. and indeed it is. And we created this MEST, matter, energy, space, time, continuum in which we function. And we became so, and then we created little creatures in it. And we became so intrigued with these creatures that we incarnated them. And as they died and, you know, evolved higher and higher, on the evolutionary scale, we reincarnated and reincarnated and reincarnated until finally, by the time we had evolved, these creatures that we incarnated had evolved to the status of mankind, we were so far removed from our origins as Thetans, we forgot who we were. And here we are, gods walking around and don't know it. And so the whole purpose of Scientology is to hit you up to an e-meter. It's a mixture of Eastern mysticism, psychotherapy, and so forth, and regress you back not only into your childhood but into prior lives where you picked up these engrams, and to deliver you from all of these things, these not only childhood traumas but traumas from past lives, and break through and to what's called clear. And you become an operating Satan once again. I haven't noticed any of them operating. But they will seriously say, yes, I'm God. I'm an operating Satan. Well, let me see you demonstrate it. They can't do it. It's a lie. And here is the origin of this lie. So he says, God's a force. It's in everything. So you don't die, you just get recycled. And you keep coming back because you're on a journey to Godhood. You can be like God. And then the fourth lie, of course, is it's in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's nothing wrong with you. It's the way you think. You've just been deceived. You're caught in the downward spiral of your own negative thinking. Oh, now we get to negative and positive thinking, okay? John Marsh Templeton, let's go back to him for a moment. You remember John Marsh Templeton? The Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, okay? The Wall Street money manager. If you went back, I think it would be, just going by memory, unfortunately I don't have a copy with me, summer of 1986, I think you would find him on the front cover of Possibilities magazine, Robert Shuler. The major interview was with John Marsh Templeton. And the first question asked him was, to what do you attribute your great success? And he said, probably to my concept of reality. I have become convinced that nothing exists except God. Everything's God. You're God, I'm God. You know, that explains why the world's in a mess. Doesn't offer any hope, as we've already said. This is pantheism. This is Hinduism. And it's honored in Robert Schuller's Possibilities magazine. A little later in the article, he says, yes, I have become convinced that Jesus lives in everybody, whether they know it or not, even whether they believe in him or not. Now, let me explain how this works. God is all. God is good. God is all. Therefore, if you see something out there that looks like it isn't good, pain, sickness, suffering, death, it doesn't exist. But you, the problem isn't out there. The problem is in your mind. You have misperceived reality. You've been told for so long, you know, and we're all in this thing together, and we all believe this common lie that limits our ability. And what you need to do is change your thinking. You're caught in the downward spiral of your negative thinking. You need to become a positive thinker. And when you begin to think positively, then you change everything. It's, again, an incredible lie. But the problem is the way you think. And you need to be initiated into this knowledge, secret knowledge, the tree of knowledge, with the dark and the light side, black magic and white magic, evil and good. And you need to understand who you are and the power that you have within you. It's laid out for us very clearly there in Genesis. Now go to Second Thessalonians chapter 2. And I believe we have the religion of Antichrist quite clearly presented to us. Verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day, that is the day of the Lord, which I believe begins with the rapture. Verse 2, he's saying, I don't want you to be shaken in mind or troubled by word or spirit letter, as from us that the day of Christ is at hand, or had already come, it really says in the margin here, my King James. Why would they be upset if the day of the Lord had come? I think those terms are used synonymously. Christ is the Lord. If they believed in a post-tribulation rapture, well, I won't get into that at this moment, but if they believed in it, why, they'd be happy. Well, tribulation is here. Day of the Lord's begun. Let's get on with it. I mean, we've got to face the Antichrist, and if we survive, why, we'll be raptured. They would only be upset if they had been taught, as Paul I'm sure taught them, that it begins with the rapture. And either Paul has been lying to them or they've been left behind. But he goes on, he says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day, same terminology that Jesus used, that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. I think that happens afterwards, and verse 6 says, you know what withholdeth or prevents him that he might be revealed in his time. But we're not going to get into that. Verse 4, talking of the man of sin, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Amazing. On the one hand, he's an atheist. He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. He does not believe in the God of the Bible. He does not believe in the God who created the universe. But he believes that we are all gods. Now, I think we would most, if not all, agree that this verse 4 speaks of a man, the Antichrist, who will ultimately sit in a temple that will be rebuilt in Jerusalem. It pertains to a temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. But it has an obvious secondary application. Our body is supposed to be the temple of the Holy Spirit. What know you not that your body is the temple of the Spirit which you have of God, and you're not your own? And for the first time in the history, this is one of the signs of the end, for the first time in the history of the world, not just a handful of yogis and gurus over in India or in the East, but millions and millions of people throughout the Western world are looking within themselves, looking within what ought to be the temple of God, to discover their higher self and to realize they are God. The religion of the Antichrist, I believe, is presented to us here, and it's already on this earth. Now, I mentioned a connection with psychology, and a friend of mine, a rather courageous woman. What?
6 minutes
left. Oh my goodness, I'm just going to end up telling you this story, I think. Rather courageous woman. She took what I was saying with a grain of salt. At least she wanted to check it out for herself. She went to, I wish she were here to tell you this. She went to a regional conference in Indianapolis of the Association for Humanistic Psychology. And she and her husband, and they managed to get in without paying the $125 fee or whatever it was, and they're on doing research. And they went into this room, it's a little bit larger than this, and there were a group of, these are PhDs and MDs, and they were cutting out, they were drawing like squirrel faces and cat faces and cow faces and serpent faces and coloring them, like kindergarten, and cutting them out and then putting them on themselves. And she and her husband are sitting there trying to not be conspicuous, watching this, wondering what in the world is going on. Now, these are leading psychologists and psychiatrists. They had a pentagram in the floor. And they dim the lights, and the person who's leading us says, now we will channel these creatures, the spirits of the creatures. And the crow says, I've just come from the North Country, and it's very cold up there, and I've come down here to get warm, and caw, caw, And they went around the room, and these various creatures are channeling this great wisdom. And they had all finished, and the woman who was leading it said, now, is there a message from anyone else? I said she was courageous, more courageous than her husband. She didn't step in the pentagram, but stepped to the center of the room, and she began to quote John 3:16. And she and her husband said, there was a rustling of unease among these creatures behind their masks, and crow, 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 the crow begins to, and the lion begins to roar, and the serpent starts coming out, and they ran out of there. Now, I mention that to tell you these are highly educated people. Okay, I have here 22nd annual meeting, Association for Humanistic Psychology. Marilyn Ferguson, one of the speakers who wrote the classic on the New Age. Russell Swikart, one of our astronauts. The daily schedule, early morning, yoga, tai chi, meditation. Some of the institutes, visualization and healing, trance states and healing. Shamanism is a 100,000-year-old traditional body of knowledge and so forth, which have become important to Western psychology and health practices. Creativity and leadership, being the wizard we are, the magician, to create our own reality. Talking about various forms of Eastern meditation. Consciousness software, tapping deeper levels of intuition and creativity, developed from guided imagery. We'll, in the afternoon, God willing, if the Lord hasn't come, and I wish He would. we will come back and talk about that, because that is so important. Listen, this final one. Education as alchemy, the art of transformational teaching. You need to know this. They are deliberately determined to transform the children in public school. We will present a practical method for educating the whole student back to where we began, holistic, mind, body, spirit, and so forth. For educating the whole student using mythology, guided imagery, ritual, and so forth. Another one, Adventures in Consciousness, the self-exploration is taught by the same gentleman who taught this, first one here, Adventures in Self-Exploration, Holonomic Healing. Psychology has become the umbrella that gives a sense of respectability. It is a major vehicle for bringing these things into the Western world. In fact, the Western psychologists speak of the yogis, the gurus, the shamans, the witch doctors. They call them the ancient psychologists. And they talk. Edgar Mitchell, which I didn't read yet, who was raised as a Baptist, who renounced his faith, who does no longer believe in this God, who believes we are all God, and so forth. He talks about this new wisdom that he has as the ancient wisdom, as I mentioned earlier. Indeed it is. Ancient as the Garden of Eden, exactly where it comes from. Well, I hope there's some cohesiveness to this. I think you can see some connections, and we will come back and speak more of it later. Try not to get into too many more details. It's just such a big topic, and we have a short time. Well, I'm just going to have to forget reading what Edgar Mitchell had to say. I just read one brief quotation. He said, "I simply don't accept the notion of an anthropomorphic deity pulling the strings. I believe that the God power, if you will, resides in all nature and reaches its peak, at least in our corner of the world, in the intellectual striving of the human being." The man who was raised a Baptist and who had that mystical experience on Apollo 14. I want to read again that letter that I began with. Is that okay? Then you'll see it in a new light now. "In your book, you compared the worldwide religion, coming in with statements of love and peace and going out with horror and suffering, to the flower child movement of the 60s. By the way, did anybody purchase, I think we had a few copies of Cult Explosion. Does anybody have a copy that they could just hand up here and let me read out of? Could I just take a quick look at that? Thank you. By the way, if you don't get our newsletter, do we have a sign-up sheet back there?
I already talked about it.
Oh, you have, okay.
It's going around the
room.
Oh, right,
good,
now.
Okay. All right. Okay. I don't have a pen. Thank you. What's your first name?
George.
George, okay. Oh, there it is. What is this? The 3rd of, wow, 3rd of April already. Okay. This, by the way, thousands of cult members and occultists have come to Christ through reading this. This is a different kind of a book on the cults. And when you loan it to a cult member, you want to tear this back page out back here, because that tells you where you will find, like if he's a black Muslim, a Buddhist, a Christian Science, whatever, that'll tell you where to find it. And we don't want him to do that, because there's not a chapter on this and a chapter on that and a chapter on that, but it's all interwoven through there. They're going to have to read the whole thing to find out what it says about their group. But Well, what they basically will find out is that they're not unique, that they're all the same. But I'm quoting a young man. He's a medical doctor right now. But he was a young man when I interviewed him. And I think he would find this interesting in relation to this letter that I'm reading. And I just took this right off the tape. He said, when I first took LSD, I took weak enough doses just to have fun and see colors and psychedelic patterns. But when I started taking really heavy doses, I entered into a relationship with a spirit being. I got a spirit guide. Now, I didn't explain, but I'm sure you all know that the New Testament comes down very hard on something that it calls sorcery. And the Greek word translated sorcery in the King James is pharmakos or pharmakia, from which we get the word drugs. A sorcerer is a person who takes consciousness-altering drugs in order to contact spirit beings to gain supernatural powers. A shaman, witch doctor. So he says, I got a spirit guide. He wasn't looking for a spirit guide, but that's what he got. After that, whenever I took psychedelic drugs, I was always guided by spirit beings. I had spirit teachers showing me lessons, making diagrams right in front of me. One of the first times I took a strong dose of LSD, I had a lesson in astrology. I saw all the signs of the zodiac and how they related to the planets and how that affected my life. I'd never read anything about astrology. Maybe I'd seen something in a paper, but I had no interest. Now I was awed. The whole thing was laid out in living color, big charts, information being printed right in front of me by spirit beings. Just to give you a quick explanation of astrology. Astrology is based upon the belief that there is a force, the Star Wars force that permeates this universe, such that depending upon the date and the time and place of your birth in relation to certain heavenly bodies, it will influence your destiny and determine your personality and so forth. That's astrology in a nutshell. So you see how the whole thing all relates. He says, on another LSD trip, the spirit guides taught me about Hinduism. I had never read anything about it. They taught me the highest Hindu vibration. Oh, I don't want to ruin this book by propping it open. One of the books I think I mentioned, Death of a Guru. Thousands of Hindus have come to Christ through reading that. I think we have a brother here who was a missionary where this dear man came from in Trinidad. He was a Hindu guru who came to Christ. When he moved to London to study medicine, on the streets of London, this is in the 60s, he met his first drug users. To his astonishment, they were Hindus, most of them. They had never studied Hinduism. They'd never been on the road to they'd never been to India, to Goa Beach, where all the hippies ended up. But on their drug trips, which sounded very much like his meditation, his yoga, his astral travel, they had met the same gods, had contacted the same beings, and had developed the same philosophy. That's why Timothy Leary, you remember him, Harvard University psychologist who got involved in drugs, when he wrote the Psychedelic Adventure, he used the Bardo Fodal, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was supposedly written by Tibetan monks who remained conscious during the reincarnation process. He used that as his guide to an LSD trip because basically it's the same. However you enter the altered state of consciousness, it doesn't matter. Rabindranath Maharaj, one day he'd been witnessing to this drug user, and he went to his apartment, and the door was sort of half open, and he heard rock music, and there were strobe lights going on, and he knocked, but no one answered, and so he pushed it open and went in. And there, in the center of the floor, to rock music and under the influence of drugs, he saw this young man going through a very highly structured dance that you would see the Hindu girls in the temple would do it. And it was a very highly structured dance, just going through all of the motions. And he had never been to India, had never seen this in his life. So you see, there is a deceiver out here. And when you open yourself up, he begins to lead down that path. So he says, on another LSD trip, the spirit guides taught me about Hinduism. I had never read anything about it. They taught me the highest Hindu vibration, Aum. I saw the whole universe dissolve into vibrations and started seeing vibrations of energy coming out of phone wires. The spirit showed me that everything came down to one basic vibration, the Aum. I saw vibes in people. Remember when the kids were talking about vibes? I had never talked to anyone about Hinduism in my life. Didn't have the vaguest idea about it. I lived in Woodlake, California. That's a very tiny little town. If there were ever any people into Hinduism in Woodlake before me, I never ran into them. I had quit high school and devoted my life to taking drugs. With spirits teaching me, I thought I'd entered into a higher education. I thought this was really more worthwhile than just dull stuff in school. One of my friends was taught transcendental meditation by spirits on an LSD trip. He never had any teaching from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Here comes Maharishi Mahesh Yogi teaching a certain form of yoga, transcendental meditation, and here's a young man gets it on an LSD trip. The whole thing, the initiation ceremony and everything from spirit beings. He didn't have to pay Maharishi a dime. So you have some understanding of where this comes from. Let me say just a word about TM. One of the best books out there is called Transcendental Misconceptions by R.D. Scott. He was an instructor in Transcendental Meditation. And he tells how when he received his first mantra. I remember being on a television show, secular show, and we were having a debate with reincarnationists. One thing leads to another. I should say a word about reincarnation. So if I don't come back to that way, you can ask me. And this the hostess, well, there was a host and hostess, and the hostess had been involved in TM. So I said, tell me your mantra. Now, a mantra is a sound that you repeat over and over. I said, tell me your mantra. She said, oh, no, we can't tell that. I said, come on, tell me your mantra. I said, didn't Maharishi tell you this had nothing to do with religion? It's purely scientific? If this is scientific, how come you can't tell me your mantra? Sounds like hocus pocus. She wouldn't tell me her mantra. I said, I'll tell you why Maharishi told you not to tell your mantra to anybody, because he told you he lies. I said, I wish I had him right here on TV. I'd like to talk to him. He is a liar. And I said, he told you that you received an individual personal mantra, right? There are only 16 or maybe 18 mantras at the most. And they are given to you on the basis of your age and sex when you were initiated. And if you began telling people your mantra, if TMers told people their mantra, they would soon find out that there are thousands of people who had their individually chosen mantra, and the man is a liar. So, R.G. Scott said, when I was initiated into it, I received a mantra. Aing was the name, A-A-I-N-G. And I was told it was a meaningless sound that would help develop my full potential and so forth. Well, he said, as I progressed upward in the organization, I appeared before Maharishi again. And, well, first of all, before that happened, he had been reading a book on Hinduism, and there, to his astonishment, he found his individual personal mantra. And it was the name of a Hindu god. And so he said, the second time I appeared before Maharishi, he gave me another word to add to my mantra, nama. Well, it's a Sanskrit word that appears 26 times in the initiation ceremony. And he, as an instructor, they say it all in Sanskrit, but he knew the translation. It means, I bow down to you. So he said, I said to Maharishi, what's going on? I was told that this was strictly scientific, has nothing to do with religion, and I find that my mantra is the name of a Hindu deity. And now you give me a word to add on to it that means, I bow down to you. Maharishi said, well, I'm sorry, a lot of people waiting to see me don't have time to talk about it. We'll discuss it later, which they never did. and he said, the third time I appeared before Maharishi, he gave me another word to put in the front of it, S-R-I, pronounced Shri. It means almost beautiful. So now his mantra was Shri Aing Namah. Almost beautiful Aing, you Hindu god, I bow down to you. Now, if you read the books on yoga by the great yogis, they will tell you that a mantra is the name of a spirit being, a god. And that the repetition of this is a call for this entity to come and possess you. So I've interviewed TMers who repeating their mantra going into this altered state, and suddenly they find themselves up on the ceiling looking down their body. Now, they're not out of their body. As James says, as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. It's a demon playing a videotape in your brain. I mean, that's the best way I could put it. It's a delusion. You're not out of your body, but you're given a delusion. Or they've got a demon on each side trying to possess them, and they wonder what in the world has happened. Some of them go insane, they commit suicide, and so forth. Transcendental meditation, very dangerous. And if I had stood here 50 years ago and said, you mark my words, in a few years you are going to see millions of people across the Western world going into an altered state of consciousness, calling upon demons to possess them, and that our whole society, and I've got to hurry quickly and get to the business world and so forth, that our entire society, from the business world, psychology, medicine, education, the public schools, will be training themselves. It's not a matter of some demons floating around trying to zap people, but that our society is literally training themselves to be demonized. You would have thought I was crazy, but it is happening. And of course it was the drug movement that opened millions of our young people to the cosmic gospel of the gurus, and then they flooded our shores, and America was ripe to hear this message. He says, later on we were heavily influenced by the Beatles. They had a record called Revolver that I'd heard but didn't understand until I heard it again in about 1968, one time when I was stoned on drugs. The song was teaching meditation. It said, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. Listen to the voices. Are they not speaking? It was about spirit beings guiding you into cosmic consciousness. A lot of the stuff the Beatles put into their albums later on, like Sgt. Pepper, had all kinds of enticements to get kids into LSD. Magical Mystery Tour had a lot of Eastern mysticism in it. They encouraged LSD, and then later advocated Maharishi Mahesh Yogi after they'd quit taking drugs and gotten into TM. Sometimes a mother or father says to me, well, my son or my daughter used to be on drugs, but now they're into yoga, and I don't understand this yoga thing, but thank God at least they're off drugs. And I have to say, I'm sorry to inform you, drugs was the kindergarten, and yoga is the graduate school. They've moved into the hard stuff now. You can get a whole lot higher on yoga than you ever could on drugs. He says, I accepted everything the spirits taught me because it had to be truth coming from the universal self. I began to believe that was what God was. I started to believe that God was the Aum, and that the universe was just Maya, an illusion, and so forth. This goes back to the gentleman back there. So, back to this letter. She was part of the Flower Child movement. I recall how exciting it seemed to be young in that era, part of a pulse that throbbed around the world. My friends and I felt that we were part of a global confederation of youth, given a new vision of peace, love, and brotherhood, bonded by drugs and music. It all seemed so new and wonderful going in. Coming out was another story. I was fortunate to get out with my mind intact, though it took me years to recognize and be freed of the spiritual bondage I'd entered. Other friends were not so lucky. Deaths, broken minds, and spirits were the order of the day. I wasn't even a full-fledged hippie, just a straight Baptist kid dabbling in fun like drugs and forms of Satanism I didn't recognize then but do now. Today, I see it for what it is, and I'm amazed at how I was deceived earlier. What did Jesus say? Beware that no man deceive you. So the time of great deception is coming. Paul said, don't let anyone deceive you. That day will not come, except there come the apostasy and so forth. I've talked with other non-Christian friends, and we've mused about that era, how after it was over, but it's not over, and I want to show you that, We look back on it in disbelief as if we've been hypnotized for a time. How about that? Well, is it over? No. The hippies, barefooted or sandal-footed, bearded, long-haired hippies of the 60s are today's political leaders. Today's psychiatrists, and medical doctors, and professors in the university. So now we're being fed it from the top down. It may not surprise you to know that Al Gore, our vice president, is a flaming New Ager. He is into all of this. Worships Mother Earth, and that's his interest in the environmental movement. And I could go on and talk about that, but we don't have time. What about the business world? See, this is not all that new, but it is accelerating. And in The Seduction of Christianity, I begin the first chapter mentioning a man named Napoleon Hill. How many of you have heard of Napoleon Hill? Well, several of you. Napoleon Hill, it is just incredible. I have a copy of his original book, Think and Grow Rich, written back in 1947, and it has the endorsement of, I think, four or five presidents and ex-presidents of the United States, the endorsement of all the founders of the major industries in the United States all endorsed this. And if you asked a businessman today, they would say that that book, Think and Grow Rich, has influenced more leading businessmen than any other book, Napoleon Hill. What was the basis of his inspiration? Napoleon Hill said he discovered that there was out on the astral plane now as I say this, you think, why in the world is this man talking about this? I mean, this is so ludicrous. It is so absurd. But yet it influences millions of people. These are brilliant people, brilliant in some ways, and badly deceived in others. He said, I discovered that out on the astral plane there was a temple of wisdom run by a school of masters called the Venerable Brotherhood of India. These are ancient beings that have evolved to a higher dimension and so forth. And he said one evening one of these entities came across the astral plane in disembodied form and manifested itself in my study, and in a vibrant musical voice said, you have been under the guidance of the great school for years, and we have chosen you to give the formula of success to the world. And the formula of success, that formula of success, literally given by demons, are you following me? To Napoleon Hill, became the foundation of the entire positive mental attitude, success, motivation world of training in the business world out there today. And it was Napoleon Hill who, along with W. Clement Stone, wrote the book called Success Through a Positive Mental Attitude. Okay? And that is where this idea came from the demons. And the root idea that they gave him was, whatever the human mind can conceive and believe, it will achieve. In other words, the power is in your mind, and it is unlimited. Now, it might interest you to know that W. Clement Stone is on the international board of Robert Schuller Ministries. He heads the Napoleon Hill Foundation, which gives a gold medal award. One of the recipient each year, one of the recipients has been Robert Schuller, and various others, and so forth. It was W. Clement Stone, a very wealthy insurance man, who put up the $1 million for Robert Schuller to send out 250,000 copies of one of his books. His book was titled "The New Self-Esteem: The New Reformation," which he sent to all pastors and seminary professors, and even many seminary students. And the basic message in that book is, we are not bad, we are simply badly informed about how good we are. And that it is an insult to the integrity of any human being to call him a sinner. that Jesus would never call anybody a sinner, that you need to build up a person's self-esteem and tell them how wonderful they are, that they're worth it, and so forth. Robert Schuller, speaking at Unity School of Christianity. Now I'm kind of moving a little farther now. Unity School of Christianity, you know that? It's a cult. One of the most deadly, dangerous cults in the world. It has its headquarters at Lee's Summit, Missouri. Unity, basically, unifying all religions. There are many organizations attempting to do this. You see, when you attempt to bring, like religious science, science of mind, when you attempt to bring a Hinduism and Christianity together, then you've got the most deadly combination. And Robert Schuller, they would deny that he was there, but I went there and got this tape, and now they deny that such a talk was ever given. And you can't find this tape, except we can send you a copy if you're interested in it. But when Robert Schuller went to Unity School of Christianity to speak to the ministers and ministers in training, not to correct them, but to commend them, and to share his church growth principles to help unity grow larger. And in the question and answer time, he was asked, "Dr. Schuller, we hear a lot about the New Age movement these days." And they went on to explain what it meant and which we are all a part. The questioner said, I quote this in Selection of Christianity, by the way. And the questioner said, "In your opinion, what is the function of a minister in the New Age?" He didn't skip a beat. He didn't deny he'd ever heard of it. He didn't deny he was part of it. He said, "In the New Age, what we have to do is positivize religion." Now, he said, that's very easy for you. Being unity ministers, you are already very positive, but you understand I deal with people you would even call fundamentalists. And they use terms like sin and guilt and repentance and redemption. And what we have to do is positivize this. Okay? Now, that brings us to positive and negative. I hate those words. We want to be positive, don't we? Well, if you're talking about magnetism, you're talking about electricity, you're talking about chemical bonding, then positive and negative has some meaning. If you're talking about morals, if you're talking about truth, it has no meaning. And talk of positive or negative becomes a smokescreen that obscures the issue. The issue is it biblical or not biblical? Is it true or is it false? And you can't say that Jesus was positive. I mean, after all, Jesus said, Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies and there won't be one stone left upon another. Well, that's pretty negative. Was that a negative confession, as Kenneth Copeland would say? And so he brought it about, he caused it by his negative confession, because there's power in words. And when you speak, if you say, I'm getting a cold, you get a cold. If your nose is running and you say, I don't have a cold, keep saying it and eventually you won't have a cold. It may take 3 or 4 days. But they literally come to believe these ideas. And I'm telling you, it came from the spirit world through demons to Napoleon Hill, and that became the foundation of what you will study in the business world: success, motivation, positive mental attitude training. The idea that you can change reality with your mind. This is just another form of what we've been talking about. Now, I want to just give you a couple of other illustrations here, because we won't turn to it, but 1 Timothy 4:1, you know what it says. Now the Spirit speaketh expressly, so you better pay attention to it. In the latter times, what are some of the marks of the last days? In the latter times, what? Some will depart from the faith. We read, and we quoted several times, Paul says, 2 Thessalonians 2:3, let no one deceive you, for that day to what? Seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. How about that? See, people who get involved in drugs or yoga, whatever it is, not only do they have certain experiences, but there is a philosophy, a doctrine, very clear, that comes through, and it conforms to those four lies that we mentioned in the Garden of Eden. And in my research, I have found, almost without exception, the people who are the leaders in this realm were not atheists. They were raised in professing Christian homes. I remember this girl that I read, and she got out. She was rescued. She says, I was just a Baptist kid, dabbling in drugs and Satanism and so forth. Edgar Mitchell, he's one of the top leaders in the New Age movement now. He wouldn't call it the New Age, although he would honor the New Age. Remember, he was raised a good Southern Baptist. Maybe some of you have heard of J.Z. Knight. J.Z. Knight at Ramtha. This is incredible. J.Z. Knight, she's been on Merv Griffin, I mean, on television across the country. She was raised a Baptist. She said, my Baptist training did not prepare me for the sudden appearance of this huge being of light in my kitchen one day. She happened to be wearing a pyramid on her head, which is one of the New Age tactics. They think it focuses the force, you know, and so forth. And he revealed himself. His name was Ramtha, 35,000-year-old entity who was a warrior in Atlantis, you know, and on it goes, who had become a god, and said that if I would follow his directions, I could become his amanuensis. I could, he would channel his great wisdom for the blessing of the world through me. And what does Ramtha say? This is part of her story here. What does Ramtha say? He says, see, it is in opposition. That's one of the evidences that this book is true. Everything else opposes it. And these beings oppose Jesus Christ, the truth. Oh, they'll embrace another Jesus. You know, a Hindu will accept Jesus. Of course. They got 330 million gods. 330 million and one isn't going to change a great deal. But we call it the embrace that smothers. But when they embrace Jesus, he no longer is the Lord Jesus Christ of the Bible, but he's another Hindu guru. Another exalted master, and so forth. And these entities all oppose the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so Ramtha taught her, these are some of the things he taught her, said, God doesn't have morals. He doesn't say, don't do this and don't do that. I'm quoting him. He said, isness is his only business. Just being. And Ramtha said, whatever you want to do, if you have a compulsion, whether it's murder or incest or adultery, whatever it is, do it. Because if you don't, you're holding back your spiritual growth. Because this is necessary to your spiritual growth. And then he says, above all, do not read that abominable book, the Bible. Okay, so what we have constructing itself before our very eyes is an anti-Christian universal religion, which has always been here in various forms of paganism, but now is being unified under various, you know, under the umbrella of success motivation training. Being unified as the holistic medicine for health and healing. We have Dr. Simonton, for example, a specialist in cancer. He's now moved to Southern California, used to be near Dallas, and he has patients visualizing the cancer, visualizing the white cells destroying it, visualizing spirit entities helping them, and is seeing some measure of success. We have it under psychology. We have it under education, and we have it even coming into the church, and we will talk about that. We're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes. We'll talk about that when we come back, and a specific part of this. Somebody was asking me at lunch about Jimmy Carter. Did I think he was a Christian? I said I had seen no evidence to indicate that he was. I'm reading from the message that he sent out on the Voyager spacecraft. Are you familiar with that? To the life out in the extraterrestrials out there. He said, this Voyager spacecraft was constructed by the United States of America. We are a community of 240 million human beings among the more than 4 billion. See, this was in 1977. Who inhabit the planet Earth, still divided into nation states, but rapidly becoming a single global civilization. So you know that he was a globalist, aiming for a one world government, the new world order that President Bush talked about at that time. And he was more honest with the beings he hoped to contact in space than he was with the people who voted him in. He said, we cast this message into the cosmos of the 200 million stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Some, perhaps many, may have inhabited planets and space-faring civilizations. If one such civilization intercepts Voyager, here is our message. This is a present from a small distant world, a token of our sounds, our science, our images, our music, our thoughts, and our feelings. We are attempting to survive our time so that we may live into yours. We hope someday, having solved the problems we face, to join a community of galactic civilizations. This record represents our hope and our determination and our goodwill in a vast and awesome universe. Signed, Jimmy Carter, President of the United States of America, the White House, June 16, 1977. The following year, he sent a message to a Congress, if I can find the name of it here. Where is it? The International Congress on Yoga, Meditation, and Holistic Health. It was sponsored by the Himalayan Institute, headed by Swami Rama, who has been involved in a lot of experiments at the, in Topeka, Kansas, the Menninger Clinic. Some of the speakers representing the various religions, Hinduism, Jainism, Tibetan Buddhism, Sufism, Christianity, quote-unquote, Judaism, they were all preaching basically what I've been explaining to you from this morning on. Let me give you some examples. One of the speakers, he happened to be a Kabbalist rabbi, Dr. Gelberman, said, God can't do anything without me. An American yogi, Roy Davis, said, our nature is identical with that of God. I'm just giving you an excerpt from their talks. By the way, I was telling them I have a tape at home because it was Ruth Carter Stapleton who led Jimmy, her brother, to the Lord, supposedly. I have a tape of her addressing Christ Universal Temple in Chicago, which is a unity church. And in that talk, she says, we are all God. Okay? Chitrabhanu, a Hindu guru, said, the belief that you are a sinner hinders your growth. In Hinduism, there is no sin. The only sin would be to suggest that you are a sinner. Another one of the speakers, and listen to this, and then we'll close with this, said, quote, I feel that there is a coming world order in which science will merge with monistic philosophy and all the world will be swept up in a new consciousness. The one distinguishing feature in that world order will be the credo, all is one. To that Congress, President Jimmy Carter sent this message. Well, I cut it down. In part it said, quote, the constructive melding of Eastern and Western philosophies and the practice in the medical and health field can be of considerable importance to society and to the well-being of all mankind, and he gave his blessing upon this Congress of melding the religions and occultism of the world together. Okay, I guess we're going to take a little break here.
5 minutes.
I've given you a number of names for the New Age movement. It's called the Holistic Movement. It's called the Human Potential Movement. It's called the Consciousness Revolution. And another word for it is the Age of Aquarius. And if you think these people are not biblical, let me explain how biblical they are. You remember Jesus sent his disciples in
to the village, you will see a man bearing a pitcher of water. The New Ager would say, do you know why the early Christians used the sign of a fish? Because they lived in the Piscean Age, the age of the fish. That comes from the zodiac. That's the symbol of the Piscean Age, is a fish. But Jesus knew that the Piscean Age was coming to an end, and that he was not would not be the Messiah or the Savior for the next age, the age of Aquarius. And therefore, when it came to the Last Supper, he sent his disciples in to find a man bearing a pitcher of water, and that he would lead them to the place where they would have the Last Supper, because this is where Jesus bowed out, and another Messiah would come, the Aquarian Messiah, the Messiah of the age of Aquarius. And they would tell you, the symbol on the zodiac of the age of Aquarius is a water bearer, okay? Doesn't that prove it? Amazing. But it deceives people. Have you ever heard that when Jesus, you see, part of this is to oppose Jesus. Christ, that's okay. Christ consciousness, you have to be very careful when you're using terms. You may be talking about God and you think you're communicating with someone and they're thinking Star Wars Force. Alcoholics Anonymous, for example. The 12-step programs that are big in the church today. They began, they come out of the world of the occult, and I don't have time to document that. I would suggest you get a book. A dear friend of mine, dear friends, Martin and Deidre Bobgan, B-O-B-G-A-N, have written it. It's called 12 Steps to Destruction. And they will tell you where this began. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, you worship a higher power. You believe in a higher power, which is God as you conceive him to be. Could be a doorknob. Could be the Star Wars Force. It could be anything, just so long as you believe in a higher power. But the Bible reveals specifically who God is. Of course, Jesus is God. They would believe in the Christ consciousness. You can be talking about Christ. You think you're communicating, and they think you mean Christ consciousness. And they may seem to agree with you. What they mean by that is, you see the relationship to the altered consciousness, the consciousness revolution. What they would say is that Jesus, the only thing that separated him, I don't really use the term Jesus very often, is Christ. The only thing that separated Christ from you and me is that he had attained to a higher state of consciousness called Christ consciousness. And when we attain to that state, then we become Christ, like he is. Not far from where I used to live in Southern California, a New Age synagogue. I don't call it that. They call it that. Machom Or Shalom is the name of it. The leading rabbi is Ted Falcon. And Ted Falcon says, the day is coming when the cry will go out, will the real Christ please stand? And when the time has come, we will all arise and the world will be transformed, because we will all have realized that we are the Christ. What a delusion. Now, have you ever heard people talk about, you know, the Bible doesn't tell us what happened with Jesus between the age of 12 and 30. And don't you understand? He studied in India under the gurus. That was where he got his wisdom. Now, this is believed by many people. I want to give you just a little bit of an apologetic for a couple of their ideas. May I do that? Because you need to have some sympathy and concern for these people, and we need to show them the lie. Why, there's a man, I forget his name at the moment, but he even claimed to have discovered in the late, I think it was 1890s, he was visiting a monastery in Tibet, and there he saw inscribed in the visitor's roll, Jesus of Nazareth. Well, before anybody who really spoke Tibetan could get there and verify it, the records were destroyed. So we're left to take his word for it. But if you read the Aquarian Gospel, for example, a very popular book, it puts forth this idea that Jesus studied in India under the gurus, and he came back, and that was what made him so popular and so powerful, and that's where his ideas came from. On the contrary, just to give you a few things that you all know, had Jesus studied under the gurus, he would have had to honor the guru tradition. Every guru, whether it's Maharishi Mahesh Yogi or Baba Muktananda or Vivekananda or Yogananda, who brought the Self-Realization Society, whatever it is, they were sent by their guru, and they must honor the guru. And Jesus, if he studied under the gurus, would have to honor the guru tradition, and he would have to honor his guru. Did he ever talk about his guru? No, on the contrary, he used a term unknown to the gurus and hated by the Jews, my father who is in heaven. The gurus, the yogis, are men who through the practice of asceticism, vegetarianism, yoga, hiding out in a Himalayan cave or whatever, you know, and practicing yoga and so forth, they are trying to realize godhood. They are men on their way to godhood. What was Jesus? Though he existed in the form of God, he considered not robbery to be equal with God, but he made himself of no reputation, humbled himself. He came down as a man. He is God becoming a man. Was he a vegetarian? No. He ate the Passover lamb. He fed others with fish, you know. Ate the fish himself, even after his resurrection. Do you have any food here? Broiled fish and a honeycomb. The Guru Gita says that the holiest act that a disciple can engage in is to drink the water in which the Guru has washed his feet. Jesus and a Guru would never wash your feet, I will guarantee you. You can't get near him. He wouldn't touch you. A Brahmin of the highest caste, Jesus stooped down and washed his disciples' feet. But Jesus offered living water, and he never said a word about washing his feet in it. Everything that Jesus said and did proves the lie of what they're saying. If he had traveled to India, he would have been a Hebrew Marco Polo. I mean, he would have been famous just for having made that journey. It simply is not true. And you know what John warns us? He says, 1 John chapter 4, and you begin to understand, as I said, the Holy Spirit in writing the scriptures covered every error that could possibly arise. And I must say I have gained some further insights after learning some of the errors. 1 John 4, he says, don't believe every spirit. Many false prophets have gone into the world. And he tells you that there's a spirit behind every false prophet. And it may be the same one behind a lot of false prophets. Remember 1 Kings 22? One spirit made 400 prophets of Israel lie. I will put a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets of Israel. Every spirit that does not confess that Jesus, the Christ, the one and only Christ, has come once and for all in flesh, is not of God. See, now, these people do not believe that. Let me give you, wow, time flies. I want to give you just an illustration. A friend of mine, he's with the Lord now, George was his name. He was an architect to the movie, to the stars. He lived in Beverly Hills, designed homes for Elizabeth Taylor and people like this, and hotels as investments for them around the world. He became a follower of, he and his wife became followers of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. They were at the ashram, Maharishi's ashram in India, when the Beatles arrived and became the disciples of Maharishi. But he became disillusioned with TM, and he was on a spiritual quest, seeking truth, even investigating Christianity. And one day he heard of a woman in Beverly Hills, lived in a huge home, and she was the spokesperson, the amanuensis for the Great White Brotherhood. Anybody have a dollar bill? You know what's on a dollar bill. The seal, the Great Seal of the United States, with the pyramid and the all-seeing eye. That is the eye in the third eye in the forehead through which the occultists see their visions, supposedly. The Great White Brotherhood just like the Venerable Brotherhood of India that Napoleon Hill was in touch with, they claim to have designed the Great Seal of the United States. And she was playing a Ouija board one day. Ouija boards are dangerous. They have done experiments in laboratories where they blindfolded the persons on the Ouija board. They scrambled the alphabet so they wouldn't know where it was, and under those conditions it moved more rapidly than ever, spelling out meaningful messages. And the Ouija board told her that if she would follow directions, she would become the spokesperson for the Great White Brotherhood, one of the spokespersons. And she did. George heard about her. And one evening he went to her home. Huge living room, at least as large as this room that we're in today. And it was filled with scientists, doctors, lawyers, university professors from UCLA, which is nearby, from USC, some of them from Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and so forth. And they were all there to draw on this great wisdom. And he said she went into a trance and put her hand over the third eye, like Edgar Casey. That's another topic. I've got to be careful. I'm going to get off on that now. He was a Presbyterian Sunday school teacher, believed in God, would go into these trances, could see. Doctors would bring the name and address of a patient. He could describe them hundreds of miles away. And they still study at the Association for Research and Enlightenment. And they still study his, you know, these readings, they're called. And one day when he came out of the trance and they told him that he had talked about prior lives with this patient who lived in, he wouldn't believe it. Oh, he's a Christian. He doesn't believe in that. But as this continued to come out, he began to believe in reincarnation. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But she put her hand over her third eye, went into a trance, and a deep male voice began to speak out of her that claimed to belong to a Hindu guru who had lived 1,000 years or so before. Now, George is was a very intelligent man. He said this was the most brilliant talk that he had ever heard. But he wasn't convinced. He thought, you know, this is Hollywood. She's an actress. She could put on this male voice, and some genius wrote this talk. So he wasn't buying it yet. But when it came to the end of the talk, the voice said, "And now, my children, if you have any questions, I will answer them. Not I will try to answer them, I will answer them." And I told you who was there. They went around the room, began to get questions. What's on the other side of the moon? What's inside the atom? I mean, on medical topics, everything, the most advanced questions that these scientists could give, and instantly came the authoritative answer. And George said he realized she couldn't have foreknown what would be asked, and she obviously didn't have this knowledge. He found himself face to face with an intelligence like such as he had never imagined existed. And this was no act now. When it came his time, he said, "You know, I've been struggling to find spiritual truth, and I've even investigated Christianity, and I wondered, why is it that when, just before Jesus died, hanging on the cross, he cried out, 'My God, why hast thou forsaken me?'" Instantly came the answer. Ah, this is the one the demon was waiting for all evening. "My child." At the moment of death, the Christ consciousness was taken from him. And finding himself just another man, he thus cried out. See? The lie. Denial that Jesus, the one and only Christ, has come once and for all in flesh. Oh no, he just had the Christ consciousness. And I believe that the Antichrist will claim to be the latest reincarnation of this Christ spirit or Christ consciousness. Now let me say a word about reincarnation, because you're going to meet this out there. I remember being, well, I think I mentioned, I was on television, and I think it was AMLA or something, a secular station, debating with some reincarnationists. And as I hurried to get into the studio, a secular studio, a woman came running up to me on the sidewalk, and she said, "Oh, Dave, I was at the church where you spoke yesterday morning. That was fantastic. I really loved it. My father was a Baptist minister, you know, and I've been a Christian for years," and on and on. And she went around to where the audience goes in, and I entered where the guests go. To find out, it was quite a large audience, and in the studio to find out where they stood, the hostess asked, "How many do we have who believe in reincarnation?" And I saw that woman's hand go up. Now, at the church where I had been that morning, the day before, Sunday morning, the pastor was not there. I mean, if I named him, you would all know his name. And his assistant introduced me, but before he introduced me, he introduced his elderly aunt, who was sitting on the front row, and he had her stand up and introduced her as a godly woman who had had such a deep spiritual influence, a godly influence in his life. She was in the audience, and I saw her hand go up. You cannot believe in resurrection and reincarnation. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after this the judgment. If I've been reincarnated 100 times and I've left 100 bodies decaying in 100 graves, come the resurrection, which one will be raised? Whichever one is raised, 99 of them remain in the grave. Death has conquered them. But death is conquered by Christ, by resurrection. Just quickly, what this philosophy teaches. Reincarnation is based, it's interwoven, interconnected with the philosophy of karma. Karma is the cause and effect, the law of cause and effect. Karma basically says, what you sow, you reap. Is that what the Bible says? What you sow, you reap, but. Well, we'll get to that. So that we, and you cannot make it right in one life. Doesn't that sound reasonable? I mean, look at this person born blind. Look at this other person born with a silver spoon in their mouth. I mean, that doesn't seem just. And this person is cut off in an automobile accident. They haven't had a chance. And they must come back and deal with these things. And basically what it says is, where you are each sitting today, the fact that you're here, where you're sitting, the fact that I'm teaching, and the very words that I'm speaking are all the results of the karma that was developed in a prior life in which we live. You see? If it goes like this, if I'm a husband who beats his wife, in this life, I must come back in another life as a wife who is beaten by her husband. If I'm a murderer, I must become the victim of murder. What you sow, you will reap, you know. There is no forgiveness. You must pay for this. Well, pardon me, I don't know if we have time to get to Roman Catholicism, but it sounds very much like purgatory. Now, you can see the problem. This is what I want you to be able to share with people who believe in reincarnation. It's a growing belief. I'll tell you why it's a growing belief. Because it will play an important role, I believe, in the delusion that will embrace the Antichrist. If I couldn't claim to be Christ if I don't have the marks of Calvary, right? Spear wound on my side. Because you are expecting the resurrected Jesus. But they are looking for a reincarnation of the latest Christ consciousness. See? So he doesn't have to have the marks of Calvary. Jesus said, I am come in my own name, and you receive me not. I'm come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. Another will come in his own name, and him you will receive. He doesn't have the criteria. He doesn't have the credentials. He doesn't even have the genealogy of the seed of David and so forth. But he comes in the name of human potential. His own name, humanism. Now, let me explain a couple of things. Number one, you can quickly see that karma and reincarnation do not solve the problem of evil. What do? They perpetuate evil. Because if I'm a murderer, I must become the victim of murder. Well, that means that the one who murdered me must then become the victim of murder. Which means that the one who murdered him must then become the victim of murder. You know, on and on it goes. It never ends. And if you go back into the past, what I'm experiencing in this life is a result of the karma of a prior life. But that was a result of the karma of a prior life, and a prior life, and a prior life. And you trace it back to the beginning, and you get to where the Hindu philosopher says the three gunas, the three qualities of the Godhead, were there in a perfect balance in the void. And something happened to cause an imbalance in the Godhead, and the prakriti, the manifestation, began, and we are all reaping the results of bad karma that began with the Godhead, and it's built into the universe. and you will never escape. Never. Because there's always another life to live to work off the karma of this life. It's a deadly philosophy. It is a hopeless philosophy. Gandhi himself said reincarnation is a burden too great to bear. So what's the solution? Yoga. That's the escape. And we have yoga, I believe, without exception, every YMCA in the United States today has classes in yoga. They think they're getting health, they're getting Hinduism. They think they're getting science, they're getting religion. And the goal of all yoga is, as I said, self-realization, to realize that I'm God. But the goal of yoga is to die. They think it's a technique for life. No, you know, the yogi learns to, you can bury him with very little oxygen, and he's motionless, and so forth. The yoga is a technique for dying. Isn't that a lie? And we have people who think they're getting physically fit by yoga, and ultimately they get hooked by the philosophy. And my suggestion is, anybody who's interested in physical fitness, why don't you take exercises that are designed for physical fitness? Yoga exercises are designed to lead you into the state of consciousness where you have a unity with God, and you become God. You realize that you are God. Now, oh my goodness, we've got a long ways to go here. The ecumenical movement we talked just a little bit about. Here is an article by a Christian, St. Paul Pioneer Press, and he is basically, what he's basically saying is, nothing wrong with the New Age movement, I wouldn't be concerned about it. In fact, there's a great deal that we could learn from it. The Catholic world, Catholicism is very New Age. Especially John Paul II, who is the greatest ecumenist the world has ever seen. John Paul II went to India, for example, spoke to huge Hindu audiences at University of Calcutta, University of New Delhi. He said, we haven't come here to teach you anything, we've come here to learn from your rich spiritual heritage. He said, what India has to offer this world is a spiritual vision of man, and the world does well to give heed to it. Okay? You probably saw in the newspapers where he was just in Africa, and he met with voodoo leaders. Do you remember that? And he told them, it will not be a denial of your religion to become a Christian. He said, you honor your ancestors, so do Christians honor their ancestors. You may know that in Haiti they have a saying, Haiti is 85% Catholic and 110% Voodoo. And every Voodoo ceremony begins with prayers to the Catholic saints. Okay? I could go on and on. You know that he, for example, he brought 160 leaders of the world's 12 major religions to India. To Assisi. I'm trying to talk too fast now. To Assisi, Italy, where he had them praying for peace. You remember that? He said, well, let me first of all tell you some of who were there. You had snake worshippers. He said, we're all praying to the same God. Good New Age language, he said, our prayers are creating a spiritual energy. Now we're back to energy, which is bringing about a new climate for peace. Who were there that he said were all praying to the same God? Snake worshippers, fire worshippers, animists, North American witch doctors, Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims and so forth. He granted permission to the Dalai Lama and his Buddhist monks to put the statue of the Buddha on the altar in St. Peter's Church in Assisi to have their Buddhist ceremony. Now, that is not unusual. You would find that in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, which is the largest Episcopal cathedral in the United States. And you might find a Hindu or a Buddhist or a shaman or whatever preaching there a Sunday morning. That's where they had Christ, the female Christ, on the cross. It is absolutely staggering what is happening. You could go to St. James Piccadilly, just off Piccadilly Square in London, where the Queen, head of the Church of England, often attends. It is a totally New Age Church. You will find lectures there. They're Tuesday night series. The Cosmic Christ, the New Age. I mean, it's just unbelievable. They celebrate Wesak, which is the Buddha's birthday. And they say Buddha and Christ are the same, you know, and we honor them both. And I mean, this is an Episcopalian church. Anglican, where the Queen often attends. Or you could have been in Westminster Abbey when they had a religious procession led by the Queen and Prince Philip, and they come in, and you have Buddhists reading from the Buddhist scriptures, Hindus reading from the Hindu Vedas, you have Muslims reading from the Quran, and so forth, and they're honoring all all religion as one. Now, this is the North American Assisi, just a flyer for the meeting. It was held in Wichita, Kansas, Interfaith Ministries, Wichita. And that's not the one I wanted. How about this? I think this was held in Wichita also. And all religions gathering together, saying we're all the same. And listen, I just give you this is the program. Amazing Grace, they began with. Vision for our community, the mayor. Prayer, Reverend Larry Greenwood, Calvary United Methodist. Greetings and peace, Jewish faith. Devotional dance, Hindu faith. Prayer, Islamic faith. Another prayer from the Buddhists and so forth. Benediction, and to just go fast. And the closing song was sung by the Community Baptist Choir. What I'm trying to say is, and I must get on to something else, this stuff is everywhere. This is just a newspaper article. I think this was in the Wall Street Journal. No, this was the Washington Post, this particular one. It says, a new aura begins at Pentagon. Meditation Club wants to put peace shield around the planet. It goes on, and it talks about the Meditation Club at the Pentagon. And they've had Soviets over there working on meditating together for peace and so forth. Now, I wanted to get in. I said there were three techniques. We talked about them briefly. We haven't had time to really cover the topic. Thinking, speaking, you remember? What was the third? Visualizing. That is the most powerful. And let me just spend the rest of the time before we have a question and answer. Then you can ask whatever questions you want. Some of the things that you would find. This is a New Age magazine. You pick them up in your New Age bookstores, your health food stores if you're interested. Nexus, this one happens to be called Colorado's Holistic Journal. Holistic medicine happens to be the topic of this one. And you just go through here and you will find everything that I've been talking about and more. This is a course. Well, here, first of all, I said one of the names is the Aquarian, the Age of Aquarius. This is the Aquarian Foundation, and the title is What Aquarians Believe. Some Aquarians, I'm just quoting this a little bit, some Aquarians consider themselves to be Christians. Some consider themselves Buddhists, and others good members of certain other great religious faiths. Yet all or nearly all Aquarians are aware of the values and truths as well as the distortions and half-truths brought to the group consciousness by each of these movements. Aquarians are aware, too, of the many similarities which may be found in the spiritual and moral precepts of Jesus, Gautama Buddha, Krishna, Babaji, and many others. Aquarians are free thinkers in their approach to life and morals, knowing the truth of cause and effect. See, that's what happened back in the Garden of Eden. You will know good and evil. In Genesis 1, a number of times, I don't remember how many times, but God says, and God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. He is the only one who could say what is good. They wanted to be able to say, decide what was good. To do your own thing. Okay? And you can't tell me what is right and wrong. You know, I will decide. And in our public schools, that's called values clarification. And they teach them not obedience, but responsibility. See, you mustn't let your parents impose their standards on you, or the church, or society, the government, but you must be responsible to yourself, to your own truth. And you can see the relationship here. The do unto others, this they follow the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. The worth of the Aquarian age new, oh, this is the, instead of that, the Aquarian New Age commandment is, you shall love and respect yourself. This is a publication from Lucis Trust. It used to be called Lucifer Trust, so you know where it comes from. They have been talking about the New Age for the last 50, 60 years. And I just thought you would find this interesting. One of the obstacles to this development, this new consciousness and this new age, is the narrow concept that so many Christians hold as to the role of Christ. Sectarianism that characterizes so much of Christian attitudes needs to be supplanted by a recognition that Christ exists for all peoples. And it goes on in that vein. I was reading the testimony of a pastor who went to a World Council of Churches conference, in a regional conference in New York. And he said, I knew we were in trouble when the first thing we found ourselves outside offering water libations to the four corners of the compass. And the next thing we go on and we talk about how narrow-minded it is to impose our view of Christ. There's the Buddha. Everybody, every religion has their Christ. And we should not do that. The latest World Council of Churches gathering, it was in Australia. The keynote speaker was from a woman from Korea, and she spoke of the spirit of Han, of hatred. And she talked about the spirits of the dead that are walking through Korea, and which must be recognized, that it is through these spirits that the Holy Spirit is at work in the world today, and so forth. And she received a standing ovation. By the way, while we're talking about Korea, let me mention Paul Yonggi Cho, who has recently changed his name to David Cho. I don't know exactly why, because he hates me, I can tell you that. And that happens to be my name. Paul Yonggi Cho has said, when Dave Hunt has a church as big as mine, then I will talk to him. His most famous, and again you will see the connection, he is most famous for his book The Fourth Dimension. Has anybody read it? Not afraid to admit you've read it. Okay, well that's good. You needn't study these things. But the Lord has called me to study some of these things to help people who are involved. I'll lay it out for you very quickly. The Fourth Dimension, he begins with a simple lesson in geometry. He says a line is one dimensional. A plane is two-dimensional. The two includes the one. A cube is three-dimensional. The three includes the two, and that's all accurate so far, as you know. Then he takes a leap, neither warranted by logic, science, nor the Bible. He says the fourth dimension is spirit. And he equates this with God. Now you see what he's done. We have a Hindu concept of God. Oh, I'm sorry, following his analogy, he says, and the four includes the three. So now we have a Hindu concept, God is all. You have no basis for putting God in a cause and effect dimensional relationship with the physical universe, or putting the spirit, the world, in that relationship, but this is exactly what he's done. Now he says that there are laws inherent in this fourth dimension, the spirit dimension, and that God knows these laws and he follows these laws. He says this was revealed to him when he asked God, how is it that the Nichiren Shoshu, the Soka Gakkai, a Buddhist occult group, they have a chant, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, and they get miracles through chanting this. He says, how come they get miracles and Christians are missing out on miracles? And he says, God revealed to him the Holy Spirit, and he even quotes the language.